Well, I'm going to start by saying I think some of you must be pessimists because you're coming to my session, which is about a bitter, bitter defeat of the working class in Australia, when there's a whole series of sessions about the generally improved fortunes of the working class in country after country going on as we speak now. But obviously, if we want to change the world, we have to inculcate the lessons of the defeats as much as the victories. And I think that's certainly what we'll try and do talking about the coal strike, 949 coal strike today. And I want to begin by actually going back to Edgar Ross, the author of this pamphlet, The Coal Front, which was published in the months after the conclusion of the coal strike by the Miners' Federation. And Edgar Ross was the editor of Common Cause for 31 years. He'd been editing it for 15 years by the time he was editing it, would have been under his editorship, when he wrote this pamphlet. And during the late 40s, he was also given a whole series of sort of fairly responsibilities inside the Miners' Federation. He was the amenities officer, but during the strike, he was one of the central and leading figures. So his account is quite interesting to look at. And he, in the opening passages of his pamphlet, his account of it, he says, "The 1949 general coal strike was significant, particularly because it represented the workers in a fundamentally different role from that in the previous economic crises. Not confused and demoralised at the gathering offensive of the employing class, but moving boldly to retain the initiative. From that point of view, it was an outstanding success." Which, if you know anything of what happened, doesn't really gel. But even he has to, I think, recognise some of the realities of the conclusion of the strike when he says later on in the pamphlet that this apparent victory consisted of, and he's sort of asking a rhetorical question and talking about the mainstream media coverage of the strike when he says, who has been declared the winners of the strike? Asked the Sydney Sun. And answered correctly, the Sydney Sun answers in our favour. The newspapers were openly admitting that the defeat of the plans to smash the Federation and render impotent the working class of the minefields. And they called for the continuance of repressive measures with the prosecution of union leaders, the permanent replacement of the Miners' Federation by the Australian Workers' Union in the open cut working, or alternatively, the continuance of the army as a labour force on the coalfields. They sought action to prevent the communists from holding office in the unions, and they voiced demands for secret ballots and so on, which are all things that the media did call for and were certainly at various stages probably plans of the government and things like that. But it hardly seems to be this smashing victory when what he's saying is that the union has only narrowly avoided being totally annihilated in every conceivable way, having their membership taken over by a hostile union, having their key officials locked up or unable to hold office, and the army working the mines in some places in New South Wales. So I think that it's sort of that whole contradiction that's in Edgar Ross's pamphlet, I think, sums up some of the problems that the Communist Party had as they went into the strike, because certainly it was a strike that I think was seen to be led by communists in the form of the officials of the Miners' Federation. And I think that's what some of the questions we want to try and answer by exploring what actually happened during the strike. So I think that I want to start by saying that the coal strike itself represented a fairly significant defeat for the working class in Australia and a watershed in the class struggle, in the sense that I think it was a fairly definitive date in time where you could say that the fortunes of the working class had been, which had been on the uptick, were stopped, and it opened up a new period of industrial stability, particularly, you know, synonymous with Menzies. And I think the defeat of the Miners' Federation, one of the most militant unions in Australia, was clearly part of that. So I just want to go through some of the background. So I think understanding the events of the 1940s and particularly the miners' strike, you need to go back to, you can't do this without talking about the Depression. And without going into all the details of the Depression, I think that the whole experience of the 10 years of economic crisis and catastrophe, the annihilation of several key unions in the late 20s and early 30s, the experience particularly for the miners of the 16-month lockout that ended in a bitter defeat for them in 1929, plus then all the added indignities of the Depression, of the homelessness, the shanty towns that sprang up where workers were forced out of the cities to live literally in shanty towns on the edges of some cities like Newcastle and Wollongong, and that coupled with the general humiliations and deprivations of applying for unemployment relief, all of this was something that workers were not going to easily or readily forget. And I think that while the miners had suffered a terrible defeat in 1929 because of the very important and strong traditions of class solidarity amongst the miners, they'd managed to hold on to their organisation and class consciousness and avoid having, having their union totally atomised by the Depression. And so that during the course of the Depression, with the radicalisation of the working class more generally, the Miners' Federation was one of the first unions where communists were propelled into the leadership in 1934. And this was the first of many unions that the Communist Party captured during this period, largely because of their work amongst the rank and file, particularly in the unemployed workers' movement, and their efforts to organise workers during strikes. One of the most famous ones in the mining was the Wonthaggi miners' strike in 1934 as well. I think it was not 34. Anyway, but the point to say is that the radicalisation of the Depression had propelled a whole series of communists into quite leading and significant positions in a number of unions, the miners probably being the most important one. And I think it's also important to spell out here that the rank and file themselves are very much a protagonist in this whole story of the coal strike. And particularly in the miners' union, they were some of the most politicised and militant prepared to do their own thing and often in defiance of the officials out of any union. That they'd been notoriously difficult to discipline during the Second World War, particularly when the Communist Party leadership of the union switched to supporting the war. And I think that it was a common occurrence to see wildcat strikes opening up in the coal fields during the war, and that I think that highlighted that uneasy sometimes relationship between the rank and file and the communist officials. And even the communists were supposed to be the most militant and determined of the officials, couldn't discipline and keep in line the rank and file. Of course, the war itself changes the economic and industrial fortunes of the working class dramatically. The shift to a war economy improves the industrial situation for workers, and in the lead-up to 1939, the outbreak of war, there's already been a pick-up in the class struggle. There's more strikes as workers start to use their better position to regain some of the things that they've lost throughout the Depression. There's a brief period of abatement in the aftermath of the bombing of Darwin, when the war seems to become more visceral and real to people. But even by late 1943-44, there's been once again a picking up in the class struggle. And after the official conclusion of the war, there is an enormous spike in the strike figures. I think one figure I saw was like there was 5 million days lost in 1945-46. And that continues throughout most of the 1940s as workers, in the better economic conditions and after 15 years of, pretty horrible deprivations, decide they want to get some of their own back. One key response, which is important in terms of understanding some of the dynamics of the coal strike during this period, is the attempts by the government to try and discipline the miners. Menzies tried repressive legislation. That didn't work. Curtin set up a variety of different commissions and a coal commission to try and regulate and stem the industrial tide of militancy on the coal fields. And by 1947, Chifley, who is by this stage the Prime Minister, sets up a thing called the Joint Coal Board, which commences operations 1947, like I said. And it was pretty much solely in charge of trying to regulate the coal fields. Its key aims in life were to raise productivity and to stop strikes. And it had a direct line into the Commonwealth Bank account, so it could literally take any amount of money without any checks or balances to be able to spend in whatever way it saw fit. It could take over mines if it thought the management of the mine was not up to scratch. And it did spend quite a bit of money trying to develop amenities in some of the coal towns and things like that. So it was an attempt, I think, to try and really incorporate the miners, to try and stem the militant tide and to try and raise productivity. And I think it's it really represented, I think, an attempt by the government to try and control the miners. But it was becoming clear by the end of the decade that it wasn't having that much success. And as workers were getting more and more restive, there was going to need to be some confrontation or some way of trying to deal with the situation. And, one of the key labour historians of this period, who actually wrote this book, Division of Labour, says that increasing regulation met with the approval of the federal government, and that the federal government actually feared a flow-on of the militancy, particularly in the mining industry, because it was seen as the leading industry for workers, and if they had too many significant victories, well, then they could spread to other industries. So this sort of attempt by the state and by the bosses, you know, in collusion with the state, I guess, to try and regulate the industry weren't particularly working. And so by the time we get to 1949, they were quite keen to try and have some kind of showdown to assert their right. And I think that, that's particularly the way the bosses and the Labor government saw 49, as an attempt to try and once and for all, you know, put the miners back in their place. Well, let's now quickly look at, I think, the two sort of key protagonists in this whole dispute, because in some ways it was a deliberate strategy of Chifley to keep the bosses out of the limelight. And in terms of the attempts to try and control the strike, to bring it to an end, it was really carried out by the Labor government and its associated trade union officials. And, you know, Labor parliamentary politicians played a role in trying to convince the miners to go back to work. But there's particular reasons for this. Well, firstly, like I said before, the Chifley government was very much, I think, painfully aware of the rising tide of industrial militancy, and his whole agenda in government was one of trying to stabilise the situation to ensure that the post-war settlement would be good for capital, not for labour, and that profits would be very much not threatened by the rising tide of working class militancy. So if one of the things that Chifley was particularly disliked for amongst our militant workers was the fact that he kept wage pegging going, which is attempts to hold down wages through the state means as long as he possibly could. And while and that was only broken by dispute in the metal trades in Victoria. And while Chifley is, you know, often fondly remembered for his sort of Keynesian revolution in terms of, you know, introducing a whole series of social reforms, a lot of them had that sort of double-edged sort of like the joint coal board, which were more aimed at, I think, at curbing working-class militancy than doing anything to actually raise living standards amongst miners or other workers. But another key part of the post-war political situation that I think really colours the strike and is important for our understanding of it is the emergence of the Cold War. And even by 1947 and then, you know, in the years leading up to 1949, this was very much a feature of Australian society, because as the imperial rivalries between the Soviet Union and the United States became more apparent, anti-communism became more and more of a refrain in Australian society, and it suited a variety of different agendas. So, for example, because the advent of the Cold War, while serving Australia's imperial ambitions, also served as an enormously useful function domestically. It allowed the bosses to campaign against the Communist Party as evil fifth columnists, and it also, at the same time, they could campaign against working class militancy as a whole, often embodied or associated with the Communist Party. And also, I think, the more widespread aspiration that was certainly very much apparent amongst workers, the idea that there should be a better society and that workers should get a better deal out of whatever the post-war settlement was going to offer. So to give you a feel for, I think, the ratcheting up of the Cold War, Lang's Communism is Treason was published early in 1949. There'd already been a special security service established by Chifley to investigate communists and communist activity, and that there'd already... the Victorian Liberal government had appointed a royal commission to investigate the aims and objectives of the Communist Party. So the state was really, you know, gearing up for a sort of offensive against the communists, and this came at the same time as various bosses' organisations were really, you know, chomping at the bit to try and establish the communists were a threat to everything in the world as we knew it. And so, of course, this had an effect on the Communist Party, that often their meetings were disrupted. They found that they couldn't get... rent spaces to hold meetings. And this was happening as early as 46 and 1947. And also a corollary of, I think, the anti-communist witch hunts was the growth of the industrial groups, which I don't really have much time to go into during the course of this talk, but certainly the industrial groups and their whole objective being to try and stamp communism out of the trade union movement, their close association with the Catholic Church, and the right-wing, most right-wing sections of the Labor Party were certainly a part of the Cold War emerging in Australian politics. But I'm not going to be able to talk much about them. But suffice to say that I think a real testament to the miners' militancy and the sort of left-wing nature of the union, the industrial groups up until the strike in 1949 just could not get anywhere in the union. They couldn't win any positions. There was very few actual self-identifying groupers at all in the miners' union. I think that was a real testament to some of the traditions of them as a union. But the ALP, I think, was quite important in prosecuting this anti-communist line, because it also reflected, I think, a more narrow interest of the Labor Party, which is that they were threatened by the growth of the Communist Party and their influence in the trade unions. And so it's not surprising that unions dominated by the ALP, and particularly the Australian Council of Trade Unions, the anti-communist rhetoric of the Cold War really helped them go after their sort of key rival and threat inside the trade union movement. So, for example, the leader of the New South Wales branch of the railways was an ardent anti-communist, and he really mounted an anti-communist crusade that sort of coincided with the 1949 strike. But he was really particularly serving his own interests, because he was concerned about the growing influence of communists inside some of the railway shops in Sydney. And so I think this is partly why there was such an enthusiasm amongst the parliamentary and union bureaucrat wings of the Labor Party for witch-hunting communists. The rank and file, I think, often objected to some of this, and there was protests within the party about some of the worst aspects of this, and particularly during the coal strike, but I don't have much time to deal with that. But there was objections. But every official wing of the ALP were right into the anti-communist witch-hunting, and particularly in a sort of very almost berserk fashion during the coal strike. So it's not surprising that in 1948, the New South Wales ALP passed a motion saying that no member of theirs or any official body of the ALP could work with any organisation that was associated with the Communist Party. That included all the Communist Party's various fronts, New Housewives Association, things like that. And I think that the general line that the Labor Party politicians, trade union bureaucrats pursued during the coal strike was really summed up by the president of the New South Wales Labor Council, when he appealed to the miners to ask the decent elements within the Miners' Federation to prevent their organisation being smashed by a few working class traitors who were called communists. And I think that was the appeal that the Labor Party politicians really made again and again and again. And most of the time, I'm happy to say, it fell on fairly deaf ears. So then let's look at the Communist Party. So were they really the big bogey? Well, I think that they had certainly grown throughout the Second World War, and that their influence in the late 40s was probably the peak of their success. So their membership had peaked in 1944 with 23,000 members. It had fallen fairly swiftly after that. I think a lot of people joined the Communist Party in the sort of flush of their pro-war patriotism, and when they worked out there was a sort of class struggle element, and when the political situation began to shift at the end of the war, they dropped out reasonably quickly. But they still had a membership in the thousands and a very significant weight inside the trade unions. I mean, also they'd gotten their first parliamentarian elected. Fred Patterson was elected to the seat of Bowen in 1944. So at the end of the Second World War, they were certainly influential. So they could boast 50 full-time trade union officials and about 250 part-time officials, and they effectively dominated not only the miners' union, but the iron workers, the sheet metal workers, the seamen, the wharfies, and that's just sort of the main ones. There's other smaller unions that they also had played fairly critical roles in. So it's not surprising then that Sheridan comments, the Labor historian, that it was literally impossible to pick up a metropolitan daily newspaper in the mid to late 1940s without reading of the enormous power and influence of the communists. Apparently, they caused everything from industrial disputes and lay behind every dangerous reform proposed by the ALP government. So even when chiefly proposed bank nationalisation, which sort of didn't really succeed because of a campaign against by the bosses, the communists got blamed. So I think while this might have fostered sort of delusions of grandeur amongst some of the CP leadership, it's not an unreasonable. There was a certain sentiment being created by the media. Perhaps I think very overstated, that the communist parties were very influential and somewhat of a threat. But I think there's one other element that hasn't been drawn out about the success of the Communist Party inside the trade union movement, which is that the actual pressures of the bureaucracy itself. By the time we get to the 1949 coal strike, some of the officials have been officials for at least 10 years, and they're thoroughly entrenched. They have some apparatus in the workplaces and the unions that they run, that they're able to get themselves elected and re-elected. And of course, I think for the trade union bureaucracy being its own unique social layer with its own, I think, very self-conscious interests, that this is as a conservatising and right-wing pressure on a party like the Communist Party. And I think by 1949, the pressures of the bureaucratisation of the Communist Party through their connections with the trade union bureaucracy was also added to by the nature of their politics, and I think they were mutually reinforcing, which is on the one hand they were, you know, quite a significant weight in the trade union bureaucracy, but the other hand was their Stalinist politics, that their shifts and turns, their zigzags, their political gyrations, which were totally driven by the, you know, often by the foreign policy needs of Russia, meant that they, these sort of two pressures reinforced each other. So, for example, so that the miners' union officials, in the instance of the miners' union, should look at them as an example. Following the dictates of Moscow, they'd opposed the war in the first part of the Second World War, for example. Then they ardently supported the war to the extent of trying to suppress strikes by the rank and file for better wages and conditions during the war. Then, as the Cold War starts to ratchet up, they then go from seeing themselves in some alliance with the Labour Party to then seeing themselves in ardent opposition and trying to foment revolution, particularly in the West. So, like I said before, the fact that the Communist Party had supported the war in the second part of the war meant flowed through to them in terms of the way they operated, seeing themselves in some kind of united front with the Labour Party. And this persisted right up until about, 1946. And that they sort of, they declared themselves as being for unity, that they wanted to affiliate with the Labour Party. They asked the Labour Party several times to do that. Most of the time the Labour Party wouldn't have a bar of it, never had a bar of it. And that they saw themselves as being active participants in terms of reconstructing Australia as part of the post-war settlement. So in the first flush after the Second World War, the Miners' Federation, and I think largely because of the Communist Party influence, supported the Joint Coal Board and its initiatives to try and address, the mining communities and things like that. And I think it's also interesting when you look at the big spike in strikes. I think it's pretty much every Labour historian I've read about this will say that the Communist Party officials, by and large, didn't play an initiatory role in any of those strikes. They might not have opposed them, like they might have in 1943 or 1944, but they certainly didn't initiate them. These are really initiatives that came from the rank and file themselves. And I think that this, I think, reflects something of a sort of the right-wing pressures of both the union bureaucracy and the Stalinist politics, that they, were unable to, I think, make anything of the post-war upsurge because of the contradictions of their own politics in terms of their flip-flopping around on the question of the war itself and their entrenchment in the union bureaucracy. And so it really was a rank-and-file initiative. And I think politically that meant that they didn't get anything out of it. They didn't cohere anything. They didn't lay down any basis of amongst more political workers. And so I think that the potential of those, that rank and file uptick was wasted. But like I've said before, by 1947 things begin to change and the Communist Party goes on very much on a jag to the left. And so they began to shift to a much more hostile posture to the ALP in keeping with the new, as they said, this is a quote from one of the party functionaries, a new feature of the present situation in Australia was the growing mass criticism of the Labour Party and the ranks of the working class. And then, like I said, the emergence of the Cold War and the intensification of those hostilities meant that now Chifley was an agent for imperialism and someone that had to be vehemently opposed. And so now the CP saw themselves, rather than working in collaboration with the Labour Party, supporting, some of the policies of the Chifley government, they saw themselves as trying to win workers away from reformism and from the Labour Party in particular. And they saw themselves as trying to do this in the context of a sharpening economic crisis. And the idea that there was some impending economic doom awaiting the Australian economy was not something that the communists had concocted themselves in their own little crazy town world. Actually, all the bosses thought this, the Chifley government thought this, all pretty much most workers thought this. This was a commonly held view, and it really coloured, I think, the 49 coal strike. But because they thought that this impending economic catastrophe, a new depression was just around the corner, they really were trying to gear up and foment revolution. And that meant that they were working against the Labour Party, trying to expose its nasty reformism, that they were trying to win workers away from the Labour Party in order to build their own ranks for the upcoming revolution. But that also had an important flow through for how they saw their trade union work, which is that the trade union struggles that they were in the position to lead had to politicise things. They could no longer be just conducted around economic struggles and just for wages and conditions, that every strike had to have some political elements that highlighted the role of the state or, you know, the nature of the Labor Party and things like that, so that they, in some ways, tried to provoke some of these things to, in order to be able to better expose the Labor Party and to, you know, show the errors of workers who had too much allegiance to reformism and things like that. So this was their general orientation as they go into the 1949 coal strike, and I think that is certainly what governed the minds of the Miners' Federation officials, that they were engaged in a strike that not only latched onto, I think, genuine grievances and demands of workers, but was an opportunity for the Communist Party leadership to try to, you know, put their orientation into practice. So the events itself of the strike. Well, how do I have time? 125. Okay, so the Miners' Federation itself had spent months in the lead-up to the coal strike, which began in June 1949, campaigning amongst its members about a particular log of claims. The miners' demands boiled down to long service leave, an equivalent to what was existing in the Wonthaggi state-owned mine in Victoria, a 30-shilling wage increase, a 35-hour week, and improvements to the amenities at the pits, which was a particularly important one, I think, for rank-and-file miners. And as various historians have pointed out, none of these demands are revolutionary. All of these demands had some existing precedent in some other industry. So there was hardly things that they were, you know, it wasn't like they were asking for, you know, millions of dollars or anything like it. That the demands themselves are reasonably modest. But obviously the strike was a lot more than just simply the legitimate demands of miners. By April, the Miners' Federation had established area committees, which were the committees that ran relief work during strikes. So it was all in anticipation of a fairly big strike. The strike itself began on the 27th of June after negotiations over their log of claim at the arbitration court in the Joint Coal Board broke down. And the coal bosses had applied for a no-strike order to prevent strikes being called during a particular period of negotiation. This was seen as an attack on the right to strike, and it meant that it sort of accelerated the strike commencing. And so the officials called aggregate meetings, which is where the strike was decided. They're big meetings of a particular district, usually of all the miners in that district. And they voted to go on strike. And like I said, that we've discussed the divisions within the labour movement. Well, they were also very much present on the Central Council of the Miners Federation. But I think it's worth pointing out, though, that generally the Miners' Federation was well to the left of just about every other union. So even the more moderate trade union officials who were on that Central Council, who were closely aligned to the Labor Party or in the Labor Party, still were more militant and prepared to strike for their members' interests than a lot of other officials. But there was constant wrangling on the Central Council between the Labor Party and the more moderate officials and the communists and officials and those associated with the Communist Party. So, for example, it was the moderates who had pushed to defer the vote that commenced the strike at the end of June, and even though the Communist Party lost that vote and the moderates were managed to win the day and actually defer the vote, the Communist Party responded by circulating leaflets throughout all the pits trying to undermine those officials who were associated with it. And I think these divisions became more and more important, particularly towards the end of the strike, in terms of undermining the strike itself. But I think we also have to understand that at the beginning of the strike, the officials themselves, no matter where they came from, were under enormous pressure from the rank and file to call a strike. The rank and file wanted to get what they saw as rightfully theirs. And Idris Williams, who was the president of the union at the time, had said in the lead up to the aggregate meetings, "Since we adjourned last Thursday, stop work meetings, we have seen hundreds of protests from lodgers against adjournment. It may be that the rank and file will take charge itself, and as a consequence, we will have a worse situation to face than otherwise. And one lodge even went so far as to promise weekly stoppages until the Central Council convened aggregate meetings." So that gives you some sense of the feeling amongst the rank and file. They really wanted to go on strike. In the first flush of the strike, they did get support from other workers and other unions. I've seen in the archives all the letters from various unions pledging support. There was a 4,000-strong rally in the Domain, which we'll see the poster for in just a moment, and the CP itself threw itself into organising efforts to support the strike. As soon as the strike began though, and this is what really made the strike a big battle, the Chifley government removed retrospective legislation that freeze the substantial funds that the unions had accrued in order to support the miners during the strike. And it made it illegal, they made it illegal to give any material assistance to workers while they're on strike. And I think the Miners' Federation leaflet that they published, which you'll see, which sort of attacks the government as baby starvers, I think is fairly accurate because it meant they were trying to really starve the workers out and to make it hard for them to stay on strike. The officials of the unions refused to hand over the funds to the arbitration court to look after during the course of the strike, and the Chifley government began jailing a whole series of officials. This is a big deal. For a Labor government to be jailing officials for a strike where I think a lot of people felt the miners had a legitimate grievance, was a particularly incendiary thing to do. It didn't have the effect of breaking the strike, it actually had the reverse effect. It meant that it galvanised the miners, and that actually the second vote they had about maintaining the strike was even more decisive than the first vote. At this stage, Labor Party politicians started touring the coalfields, trying to convince the workers to go back to work. They got a very hostile reception. There's all kinds of accounts in this book of Labor Party politicians being booed and heckled, and sometimes having to be escorted away by the cops because they're worried they'd get lynched in the mining towns. But it didn't stop the fact that the miners were actually increasingly isolated because the ACTU and the ALP-controlled unions backed the government on the fund freezing legislation, passed motions supporting it. Sometimes they found it very difficult to pass the motions in their unions because there was hostility from the rank and file, but generally gave encouragement to the government and isolated the workers. And obviously this began to fray, I think, some of the support for the strike. The workers at the Collie Mine in Western Australia went back early, and the officials had difficulty trying to keep Tasmania and some lodges in Queensland on strike. And even though I think the bulk of the strength of the strike was in New South Wales, obviously it couldn't have been good for morale to start to see that there's workers going back to work only halfway into the strike. So the final weeks of the strike were marked by the government's next revolting move, which is that they, on the 27th of July, Chifley and the ALP cabinet voted to send the troops in to start mining coal in the open cuts. And I think this is a fairly deliberate ploy. I don't think the government had any idea that it was ever going to do anything to try and undermine the restrictions that had been placed in pretty much everything because of coal shortages and the quite significant effects that the coal strike was having on everyday life in Australia. It was deliberately designed to try and show that they were serious and to intimidate them, but also I think it was aimed at trying to drive a bit of a wedge between the pit miners, who were more militant and had the traditions of the miners' union, and the miners in the open cut miners, who were newer, didn't have the same traditions, and were, I think, more easily intimidated by the army being used as scabs. The actual coal they managed to get was absolutely trivial, and like I said, it was a show of force. And even with the strike fraying at the edges and the full weight of the state being brought to bear on the Miners' Federation, in one of the accounts I read by Philip Deary, he speculates, he thinks that there was still support amongst the rank and file, that they were still quite committed to trying to stay out and strike and trying just to endure in order to win against the government. I think the thing that really started to undermine the strike and eventually led to it coming to an end was actually the wrangling that happened inside the Miners' Federation and the fact that the more moderate officials, I think, took fright at all of the repression, were under enormous pressure probably from the Labor Party and from other sections of the union movement, and also alarmed at the difficulty of some of the more backward mines and lodges to stay out on strike. And so they started to campaign for a back-to-work vote in the union. And so the Northern District leadership started campaigning. They won a vote at the Board of Management, which is one of the sort of subsections of the union, to get a vote up in the lodge, in the various districts and lodges. And I think it really highlights the response of the Communist Party officials, highlights some of the things we discussed earlier. They immediately, rather than appealing to the rank and file, they immediately tried to bureaucratically outmaneuver them to stop the vote. This was unsuccessful. The aggregate meetings were called. The leadership of the central council leadership of the union put through a vote to continue the strike for another week, and everywhere those votes went down, even in places where the Communist Party obviously thought they were going to win, like Wollongong, which had been one of their bases of support. So the rank and file by this stage, I think, were clearly determined to go back to work, and they weren't going to keep striking. And so the miners returned on the 15th of August 1949. Okay, so can we just queue up the... And I'll just quickly show you. This is pretty much the Common Cause, which is the miners' journal, every week of this 8 weeks of the strike. So just want to quickly go through it. You get a sort of sense of what it was like. One of the slides is out of order too, I think.
Keep going.
Yeah,
it was the editor of
Rank and File. No, it was Edgar Ross, the Communist Party member. And so that's just after they had the second vote where it was overwhelmingly to stay at work in July. Okay, and there should be just a few, that's the last one, and then there should be just some of the pamphlets. So this is the rally and the debate. Baby starters. This is a Labor Party pamphlet circulated amongst the miners, directed at the miners against the Communist Party. This is the Communist Party response into the Labor. Well, I think it's aimed at a more general audience than just the miners, but it's aimed at obviously workers in the ALP. And that's the end. Okay, so that hopefully gives you a little bit of a flavour. To conclude, well, why did the strike lose? And I guess the other question it raises is, could the strike have won? Well, I think the first thing to say, the bosses themselves were very committed to winning. They saw the strike as a fairly key class battle. I think up there with things like the MUA dispute in 1998, attempts to try and break the back of a militant union to try and push back the class as a whole. So they were keen to suppress the strike, and the Labor Party were particularly keen to carry that out. Obviously, the Labor Party played a disgraceful role. They drove Australian society to the right and did everything they could to isolate and undermine the miners. For the miners to win, I think it would have required them to stay out for longer, a lot longer. Obviously, the strike was having an enormous effect on society, but every week they stayed out, I think they also helped to undermine public support, because one of the critical things was the public support collapsed for the strike, I think, under the pressure of the propaganda war and the sort of inconvenience of the stoppages. So they would have had to have endured for a lot longer and prepared to be very isolated for a long time. But what does it say about the Communist Party leadership? What could they have done differently, I think, that might have, changed the fortunes of the strike? Well, I think there's a whole series of things we can draw out here. I think, firstly, the bureaucratic orientation of the Communist Party leaders. The whole politics of exposure versus trying to play a role in leading workers and encouraging workers to learn from their own experience. Because I think even just the way that they talked about exposing the Labor Party was always aimed at just sort of, this sort of mechanical idea, we'll just expose the Labor Party and then workers will just leave and walk straight into the ranks of the Communist Party. Well, obviously it doesn't work like that. And I think that the Communist Party missed vital opportunities to relate to workers when they were radicalising, when their own experiences were telling them about, things about the way in which the world works. Lots. So, for example, during the end of the Second World War and such. Obviously, I think there's a legacy from the fact that the Communist Party was, tried to act as strike breakers during the Second World War. I think that undermined their authority and their ability to relate to rank and file workers. So I don't think they really carried a coherent rank and file, educated with the right kind of politics, and I think that helped to sow confusion and resentment, and often that forced them to rely on more bureaucratic methods to get their way, as I think we saw in the way in which the strike ended. And also, I think, flow through to very little orientation to the Communist Party doing anything to organise the rank and file for their own relief. And if people have read about the Wonthaggi strike in the 30s, it was the sort of textbook example, I think, what a revolutionary party should do in order to organise workers so that they can withstand the full pressure of the state when they're on strike and those kinds of things. Well, I don't think that kind of thing happened. And there's two things, I think, that point to this. The first thing is that Edgar Ross, who was played a really leading role in the strike, obviously didn't have much of an idea about this. I've seen the letters in the archives that he solicited from rank and file workers, asking them, tell me what you did during the strike. I'm writing this pamphlet about the strike. What did you do to try and maintain workers' morale and to feed people during the strike? The fact that he didn't know about this himself and obviously meant that he wasn't in any way associated with it or organising it during the course of the strike. And I think that is backed up by the example that's in Philip Deary's account of the strike, where he talks about Queensland, which was a unique state where the Trades and Labour Council there actually supported the strike, unlike every other Trades and Labour Council. Sure. And that where the relief committees were only set up in the second or third week, and where there were reports in the media of some of the miners literally starving by the fourth and fifth week because they didn't have any access to food or relief in the course of the fund freezing. So that starts to suggest that I think the orientation to rank and file and to trying to galvanise the rank and file and their own self-activity to keep the strike morale and the keep people going during the strike wasn't there. And it was actually the weakening in Queensland that was one of the things that gave the Northern Lodge, the Northern District officials, the real sort of impetus to be able to campaign to end the strike. And I think the gyrations of the Labor Party themselves over the previous 20 years have done much to alienate people in the Labor Party, and, you know, that they're shifting from, you know, you're fascist and now we want to be in alliance with you to now we're against you again, without any sort of consistent basis of trying to relate to both the party in power, but also and the official party, but also its rank and file members in the unions and elsewhere, meant that I think that the Communist Party missed opportunities to be able to put more pressure and to undermine so much of the government's attempts to isolate the strike. So, like I said, the strike itself was a bitter defeat for workers. The miners were defeated. They got a modicum of a long service claim, I think, in the next few years after the strike, but they didn't win any of their other demands. They only got the 35-hour week in 1970. So that gives you some sense of some of that. And I think that it's obviously that the success of the Chifley government in breaking the strike and undermining it really opened up the way for the Menzies and the whole Cold War offensive, because Chifley actually lost the government lost power about 3 or 4 months after the strike. I think that the driving Australian society to the right, tacking your own support basis, you know, we've seen so many Labor Party politicians do, end up just driving Australian society to the right and opening up the space for Menzies and his unchallenged, you know, rule of 23 years. So I will leave it there.